Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into the big story in the news, and that is the testimony of Rupert and James Murdoch and Rebecca Brooks before the UK House of Commons Culture Committee, which went from humble to pie in as much as Rupert Murdoch went out of his way to express humility and say how he was humbled by the hacking scandal. Then later in the hearing, one Johnny Marbles attacked him with a pie made of shaving cream. First, we'll go to London and speak with the deputy editor of the British satirical magazine Private Eye. Francis Ween joins us. Then we will examine further the inquiry into the activities of News International and the Murdoch media empire with media critic Robert McChesney, the author of The Death and Life of American Journalism and Will the Last Reporter Turn Out the Lights? The Collapse of Journalism and What We Can Do to Fix It. We will not just discuss the events in London, but the influence here in the United States of Rupert Murdoch on journalism and the media. I'm now joined by Francis Ween, who is a journalist, broadcaster, and writer. He is a deputy editor of the satirical British magazine Private Eye. He has written for a variety of publications and regularly appears on such BBC programs as The News Quiz. His books include the award-winning biography Karl Marx, A Life, Idiot Proof, A Short History of Modern Delusions, and Strange Days Indeed, The Golden Age of Paranoia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Francis Ween.
Well, thank you for having me.
And quite a day in London. I've been watching it online, of course, the House of Commons Culture Committee, grilling both Rupert Murdoch and his son James, and then later Rebecca Brooks.
Well, good for you. I mean, I think it probably wasn't quite as lively and entertaining as some of the mass audience might have hoped or expected. Because it's been built up, you know, this is the great showdown, the great gladiatorial combat where Rupert and James Murdoch get their comeuppance and this mysterious Medusa-like figure of Rebecca Brooks and collapses and with a stake in her heart or something. And actually, a lot of it was quite dull. And then magically, I mean, the only thing, you know, I found myself sort of, the only good bit, actually, very early on, when Rupert sort of tapped James on the arm to interrupt him, because he'd obviously got this prepared line, and he was desperate to get it in, saying, I would just like to say one sentence. This is the most humble day of my life. And my youngest son, who's a connoisseur of The Simpsons, said, well, as Homer Simpson would say, no, Rupert, this is the most humble day of my life so far, which I thought was very good, because he's going to have a lot more humble pie to eat in the next few weeks and months. But apart from that, until the slapstick came along, until sort of Cranky the Clown, or whatever he's called, turned up with the custard pie, a lot of it was fairly dull and not a good advertisement for British members of Parliament, I'm sorry to say, because it was sort of terrible. One of those awful contests where you don't really want any side to win, because you think this is a contest between members of Parliament who in Britain have been utterly discredited in the last couple of years since they were all caught fiddling their expenses, and media mogul Rupert Murdoch, who, by and large, not a hugely popular figure. And Murdoch then decides to try and shift the blame onto his lawyers, an even more reviled class of people, and journalists are involved, who everyone hates. So it is like a terrible sort of snake bit of cobras and adders all rushing around trying to bite one another to death, and the observers think, they're all awful.
Well, I must say, though, the moment of comedy, I guess, since this activist is a comedian. His name is Johnny Marbles, believe it or not.
Yes.
He tweeted...
The so-called left-wing anarchist comedian who thought it would be a good anarchic idea to launch an attack on an 80-year-old man in front of the world's TV cameras. And, of course, the only possible consequence of that is to win enormous sympathy for poor old Rupert, you know, rather doddery old Rupert, who spent large part of the hearing trying to give this impression of, well, I don't know about this, you know, I'm getting on a bit, I'm a bit old myself. Perhaps my son would know about it, I don't really remember these things. And so he gets lots of sympathy for Rupert, and even more, turns Rupert's wife, Wendy Deng, the incredibly scary Wendy, into a superwoman.
Yeah,
she's now being lionized everywhere. I mean, she's the hero of the hour who leapt forward. And even more wonderfully, because one of the many British institutions that comes very badly out of this whole scandal is the Metropolitan Police, which turns out to have been in bed with the Murdoch Empire. And yet again, the Metropolitan Police, another very bad day for them, because old Wendy hurls herself at the assailant. And about several minutes later, it seems, a rather slow... PC plod, British bobby, ambles or sort of hops along to try and rescue Rupert when it's all over.
No, well, indeed, it was a Bruce Lee moment there where she flayed into this fellow.
I know. Who, scary. The flying tiger, hidden dragon, or whatever it's called. All over again.
But this Johnny Marbles fellow did shout out as he tried to splat Rupert Murdoch with a shaving foam pie in the face. He shouted out, "You naughty billionaire."
That's quite a good line. I didn't hear that on my telly.
Well, that's what the BBC are reporting.
The awful thing about it is that it's terrible to find oneself feeling some sneaking sympathy for Murdoch. But I did worry in advance that Rupert might get away with it. And particularly that moment when he was asked about how prime ministers, not just in Britain but all over the place, are always dancing attendance on him and inviting him in and so on, although they invite him in through the back door every time, which was a very telling point. He just sort of laughingly said, "Yeah, I'm always asked to go through the back door. I don't know why, because they're so ashamed of it." But they always are. And at one point he said, "Yeah, well, they do invite me. I wish they'd leave me alone." And actually, there's some truth in that. It's not as if he imposes himself on them. They impose him on themselves. I mean, it's like, you know, they are like humans who have created an imaginary god and then bow down and revere this god and say, "Oh, please don't throw thunderbolts on me. I promise to be good. I'll do whatever you say," forgetting that this is a figment of their imagination. And I think there's a lot of that with Rupert, that politicians, particularly in Britain, but also in Australia and to a degree in America, I think, over the years, have persuaded themselves that they can't afford to antagonize Rupert because he's so immensely powerful, you know, this great Wizard of Oz-like figure. And actually, he's not. Insofar as his newspapers in Britain are thought to be powerful, it's because they tend to back the party that wins a general election. But it's the other way around. What happens is they see which party is ahead in the polls and is likely to win, and then Rupert says, "Right, you're going to back that one." So he backed Mrs. Thatcher, first of all, in 79, and then when the Conservatives had run out of steam, he backed Tony Blair and the Labour Party. When Labour ran out of steam last year at the election in Britain, he backed the Conservatives. And David Cameron became Prime Minister. And each of these Prime Ministers thinks, "Gosh, I got here because Rupert supported me." And you think, no, you would have got there anyway. Rupert supported you precisely because you were going to get there. You don't owe him anything. But it works every time. And they think, "Oh, I must do him some favours. I must let him take over more businesses, or I must let him dictate my line on this, that and the other."
Again, I'm speaking with Francis Ween, the deputy editor of the satirical British magazine Private Eye. And by the way, the fealty towards Murdoch was expressed, I think, by the Tory MP Louise Mensch, who was interviewing at the time when they had to suspend it because of the pie incident. And then when they came back, she said, "Oh, you've shown real guts, Mr. Murdoch." I mean,
a bit of shaving foam. I know. If that's real guts, let's say Rupert is never sent to Afghanistan.
Well, did Private Eye coin the phrase "the dirty digger"?
Certainly did. Yes, in 1969, I'm proud to say, when Rupert came to Britain from Australia to buy the News of the World, the paper he's just closed down all these years later, we had a thing in Private Eye. I can't really say it on the radio because it was so rude, but anyway, "Something off, dirty digger, get back down under and leave us alone. We don't want you coming here corrupting us and wrecking our culture and wrecking our newspapers and wrecking everything." And that's pretty much been our line over the years. You know, we have regarded Rupert as a malign force, and we just wish he'd go away because everything he touches turns to dross. And it's probably not quite true, because after all, he did finance the creation of The Simpsons in America. And actually, he has supported the Times newspaper in London, which loses money and always has. And in a way, that's a sort of public service, I suppose. On the other hand, that is paid for by basically the crimes of the News of the World, which the News of the World and The Sun, his down market tabloids, make a fortune to subsidize his elegant, thoughtful broadsheet, The Times of London. So The Times is sort of, you know, in a very odd position of living on immoral earnings, with the brothels down the road providing all the money to allow it to run an art gallery, essentially, and trying to pretend that it doesn't know where the money comes from. And it's and I've just put together the latest issue of Private Eye. Ian Hislop and I, the editor and deputy editor, we were putting it together yesterday, and I was doing all our Rupert Murdoch stuff. And I put together a six-page spread, including lots of old Private Eye front covers and cartoons and things about Rupert's malign influence over the years, but also about the pathetic attitude of politicians who allow him to have that malign influence, who don't call his bluff, who for well over 30 years now in Britain have allowed him to dictate the terms and allowed him to pretend and to convincingly pretend that he is, you know, he is Oz the Almighty rather than this sort of feeble man behind the curtain twiddling knobs and things.
But you're what you warned or pronounced back in the 60s about the dirty digger and go home and we'll leave the expletives out, what you said actually has come true. He has denigrated and
well, I think he has depraved and debauched the country. I mean, I have endless arguments about this. In particular, there's a man called William Shawcross. I don't know if you've ever come across him. Who's a British author and journalist.
I think he may not be Sir
William, since he wrote a biography of the Queen Mother. But he wrote a biography of Rupert Murdoch in about 1991, I think, 20 years ago, which was more or less a hagiography, it seemed to me. And I wrote a very long review saying so. And then I was asked in the first issue of The New Yorker, edited by Tina Brown, to write a little piece about it. So I did. And Willie Shawcross got very upset and had his friend John le Carré send letters to Tina Brown, which he copied to the Boston Globe, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, everyone else, saying this is disgraceful, bringing gutter standards of English journalism to American magazines like the New Yorker. I was bringing gutter standards by mentioning that Willie's book was rather a hagiography of Rupert Murdoch, rather than Rupert bringing the gutter standards. And on the strength of which I was sacked from the New Yorker on the say-so of John le Carré and Willie Shawcross. Purely because my dad criticised Rupert Murdoch. And it's quite funny, the idea that I lost my job, on The New Yorker, purely because I suggested Rupert Murdoch was a bad egg, and I was then sacked for bringing yellow journalism and gutter journalism to America.
Well, indeed, there's a...
So unlike dear old Rupert with his fine standards of news on Fox News and things. Actually, the one thing we don't have here is Fox News. His Sky News, which is a British equivalent, is covered by broadcasting regulation and is actually a very, very good news channel because they're not allowed to pontificate or to have political bias, and it's actually a rather good news television channel. It's also different.
You also have the BBC, which is a check and balance on Murdoch. He loathes the BBC. His sons had a jihad against it.
Gave a speech a year or two ago, basically saying, "Why don't you go away and die? We hate you. We're going to kill you. It's all out war." It's one of the many pleasures of this scandal is seeing, all the cockiness and the vindictiveness of the Murdochs, father and son, in recent years. Saying the uselessness of the wretched liberal newspapers in Britain and the wretched BBC, and now having to abase themselves at least a bit and say, "Oh, we're so sorry. And they just can't, for a week or two, they can't be their usual vicious selves. They've got to have what Rupert called the most humble day of my life. And I just think the longer the humility continues, the better for all concerned.
Well, but both of them went out of their way to applaud the British press, the freedom of the press, how wonderful it is we have all this freedom and diversity in the press. Of course, this hearing was not about press freedom. It was about breaking the law.
I know. It was a complete non sequitur. And I think that's why Rupert has got away with it. I mean, even if he hadn't been attacked by Johnny Marbles, the ludicrous anarchist, I think he would have got away with it because there's a twinkle in his eye. And he managed to say, "Well, I believe in newspapers." And of course, one thing everyone knows about Rupert is that he's sentimental about newspapers. He's not sentimental about television. I mean, in television, he has other agendas, and that's where he makes his money. But when it comes to newspapers, because he mentioned today his father, Keith Murdoch, and repeated this complete fiction about the old story about how his dad, Keith Murdoch, he wasn't a rich man, he was a poor man, but he was a great journalist because he exposed the appalling behaviour of the British at Gallipoli, and that was his great scoop, which has been debunked so many times over the years. But anyway, Rupert still does it. And my dad, he bought a little paper in Adelaide to leave me as my endowment, my inheritance, because he wanted me to run newspapers and to do good in the world. And Rupert has this narrative in his head that's he's a newspaperman at heart, and he came into newspapers to do good in the world. I mean, even though any glance at his career suggests otherwise. That's what he still believes. I mean, it makes you want to watch Citizen Kane, this scandal. A number of times in the last few days, I thought, I must try and find my old video or DVD of Citizen Kane, because there are so many echoes there about Rupert's childhood coming back to haunt him all these years later, and no doubt Rosebud will appear eventually. And it's also very like Watergate. It makes me feel very nostalgic for the early 70s. Because I remember at the time of Watergate, I was obsessed by that, and partly because there was such an interesting cast of characters, and it was almost impenetrable if you didn't keep up. If you missed a day or two, then you said, hang on a sec, what did Jeb Stuart Magruder say to John Dean on the 3rd of July? And you had to be really on the ball. And it's like that with this Murdoch thing. A lot of the questions today, I think the international audience will have yawned over because they had no idea what they were about. And it's only complete nerds like me, sort of geeks, who follow it and think, yes, that's the point. Ask it. What right. Colin Myler knew on the 3rd of September 2009. It's just like that thing. And we have almost an equivalent cast. And also the joy of Watergate, remember, was when will people betray Nixon? And also the joy of it was because Nixon, for years, had made enemies and sort of quite liked being hated because it just made him feel even more hateful. And Murdoch's like, you all hate me and I don't care, except he does care. And so by the time his comeuppance comes, there are a lot of enemies he's built up over the years or people he's intimidated or cowed into being nice to him over the years who then think, right, now's my chance to get him. And there's tremendous schadenfreude. I think John Stewart called it a schadenfreudegasm the other day, a lot of people in Britain in particular are experiencing now, I think, at the sight of this. And it was just like that with Nixon. I mean, I was just obsessed and fascinated, but also gleeful at the whole progress thing. I thought, he's going to get it. We're heading that way. And it was just like that. I was just waiting for the senior lieutenant to turn against him, which I think will happen quite soon, because the evidence today, Rupert was clearly blaming certain people, such as the lawyers and also the last editor of the News of the World. They're getting to the point where so much stuff will come out that they have to, in order to save their skins, turn Queen's evidence, as we say over here, turn supergrass and grass up all their colleagues to try and protect themselves.
Again, I'm speaking with Francis Wheen, the deputy editor of the British satirical magazine Private Eye. And, of course, the House of Commons Culture Committee was where this hearing took place today. It was disappointing, as congressional hearings are over here. But I thought the real piece of evidence, which nobody pursued particularly, is that the hacker who's at the heart of all of this, Glenn Mulcair, apparently is still on Murdoch's payroll. So on the one hand,
he is, and I'm very glad to have that confirmed, because I first wrote this in 2007 when Mulcair, the hacker, and the News of the World's royal editor, a man called Clive Goodman, were sent to prison for hacking the phones of Prince William and Prince Harry and people like that. Someone at the News of the World tipped me off and said, you'll never guess what. I mean, this was after they'd been convicted in jail. You'll never guess what. News International is paying them off. It's giving them a very large payoff in return for a little contract in which they promised never to speak about it, and their silence is bought. And so I wrote this in Private Eye, as I say, about 4 years ago. I put it to News International and the owners of the News of the World, and they refused to deny it or confirm it. They said, well, we're not prepared to comment, so I wrote the piece anyway and said, well, I think their silence speaks volumes. If it was untrue, they would be quick to deny it. It's perfectly clear that they haven't. A mere 4 years later, this has been confirmed. And, as I've also been writing for several years, that that Murdoch has continued paying the legal fees for Glenn Mulcair, this pathetically sleazy private investigator. I mean, Raymond Chandler would have sacked him instantly. I mean, he's just got no redeeming features at all. No charm, no sort of whiskey-sodden metaphors or, nothing attractive or amusing about him. Just reeks of sort of cooking oil, essentially. and Murdoch, finally today, James Murdoch, in a very roundabout way, admitted that they are still paying all his legal fees. Hundreds of thousands of pounds it now runs to, in order to fend off cases from Jude Law and various other actors and celebrities who've been pursuing the News of the World. Because, of course, if Glenn Mulcair's notebooks were produced in evidence, then it would be clear that he had been doing all this. And so he went to court to try and stop these notebooks being allowed. This was all paid for by Rupert Murdoch. Rupert may say he didn't know, and he may even convince people he didn't know, because he's an elderly man, lives in New York, and as he said, the only person I really talked to is the editor of the Wall Street Journal, which is very nice for him, I'm sure. But still, you know, he is in charge of the company. His son, James, is in charge of the company in Britain and Europe. And Rebecca Brooks was chief executive of the specific company owning the News of the World. And all these people, even down to Rebecca Brooks, the one with the amazing hair, say, oh, no, I didn't know. It was basically saying it was below my pay grade. One wonders if the office cleaner knew. You know, who was the person who was responsible for this thing?
Well, you know, Bloomberg over here reporting that prior to this hearing, senior News Corp executives were, and shareholders, I should say, and members of the board of News Corp were basically saying that Murdoch's performance was very poor in the rehearsals, and if he didn't do well in the hearings today, perhaps the Chase Carey, the chief operating officer, should be replace him as chief executive officer, and then they can.
Well, it's about time someone stood up to them. Because I mean, the trouble is the structure of News Corp. I mean, I expect you know, is they have these two, you know, A shares and B shares, and they have voting shares and non-voting shares. So most of the shareholders have no votes at all in how News Corp is run, whereas the Murdoch family shares are all voting shares. And so although he only owns, you know, a fairly smallish percentage of the company, in terms of voting shares, he is pretty well in control. So it means he can appoint his son, James, to be chairman and chief executive of the whole operation in Europe without anyone saying, hang on, are you sure he got this on merit? Although one of the MPs today did ask that, and Rupert said, yeah, very much, he got it on merit. Oh, brilliant, you know. And the daughter, Elizabeth, has recently sold her TV production company called Shine to News Corp, her father's company, for an incredibly overinflated fee. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars for a company that really isn't worth that much. And again, shareholders grumble, but there's nothing much they can do. But in terms of corporate governance, it's an absolute disgrace, this company. And old Rupert saying, you know, I'm very much a believer in business ethics and probity, and we have this statement of ethics that we give to every new employee when they join. All 53,000 of our employees have this and memorize it, you know, like the Chairman Rao's little red book. They recite it every morning, I expect. It's all complete rubbish. It's the worst. Even, you know, other business tycoons who under other circumstances might admire Rupert say he is a disgrace because the return on capital is actually very bad in, you know, in normal terms. But there's nothing they can do about it because shareholders at News Corp have no power. But it does seem to me that if all the shareholders, voting and non-voting, all the non-Murdoch shareholders ganged up together, they could just about bully him into submission and tell him to take a back seat. But they won't. I mean, they're in awe of him.
As far
as I can see. And so they allow him to have, you know, Harpo Murdoch and Zeppo Murdoch and Gummo Murdoch and Murdoch's yet unborn running this company into the ground.
So just in closing, what is the role of these celebrities like Jude Law? My understanding is I thought it was Hugh Grant. We had a minor accident and suddenly they were News of the World people there. And he said, how come you guys knew about this before the tow truck arrived? And I mean, is that true? And that began?
There were no dark arts involved in that. I think for once that was a fluke. What happened was that Hugh Grant was down in Kent in the southeast of England and his car broke down. And there was a bloke called Paul McMullen, the former features editor of the News of the World, who had retired to run a pub down nearby in Dover. And McMullen was driving along and saw this broken down car and went to help. And as he pulled up, he thought, that's Hugh Grant. And McMullen, being a former tabloid reptile, always keeps a camera in his glove compartment, just in case. And so he said, oh, Hugh Grant, all right, I can help you out. I'll give you a lift. In return, could we have a picture taken of you and me? So the picture was taken, and Hugh Grant sort of joked and said, and I think he then took him to the pub and bought him a drink. And Hugh Grant joked and said, oh, I expect you'll flog that to tabloids. And McMullen said, oh, no, I'm past all that. And it appeared the next week in the Mail on Sunday tabloid newspaper. But Hugh Grant thought that was fair enough. He gave him a lift. But on the other hand, when he became increasingly interested in whether his phone call's been bugged, he thought, I know. The man said to me, do come for a drink if you're ever down in Kent again. So he went down to the pub with a secret tape recorder. That was the joy of it, a secret microphone, hidden mic on him, and had a few beers with the guy. The guy admitted everything and admitted how much hacking had gone on and how it had been done, not aware that he was being, he was hoisted by his own hidden mic, as it were. And Hugh Grant then wrote this up in the rather less tabloidy circumstances of the New Statesman magazine, the thoughtful Fabian left-wing weekly. And it really all took off from that part of this story, because McMullen then found himself at his pub in Kent being besieged by other people wanting interviews, and he's now become a regular fixture on British TV as the man who's willing to speak because Hugh Grant got him to confess everything. So,
and of course the other guy that was the whistleblower just suddenly dropped dead. So
yes, I know. Well, I mean, it is very odd, all this. I mean, that did remind me a bit of Watergate. That this morning's papers in Britain almost all led with the death of this former News of the World person, the whistleblower, the one who blew the whistle to the New York Times, a guy called Sean Hoare. And actually his death, it was sort of fairly, wasn't exactly unexpected, because he had had terrible drink and drugs problems. I mean, his health was not good. But nevertheless, the fact that he had died at this precise moment meant that it was immediately suspect. And it's the nature of these things that all sorts of red herrings emerge. And I'm sure conspiracy theories galore and are doing the rounds of the wilder reaches of the internet, which I haven't had a chance to look at, saying that he was murdered by David Cameron or something like that. But then at the same time, there was this wonderful Woodward and Bernstein moment in today's papers when it turned out that Rebecca Brooks, the chief executive of News International, she and her husband Charlie have a very grand flat in Chelsea, as well as a house in Oxfordshire where they hang out with the David Camerons at the weekends. In a bin underneath their block of flats in Chelsea, their apartment block, was found a bag which had a laptop, a mobile phone, and various papers in it, documents. And this was taken to the police, and it turned out to belong to Rebecca Brooks's husband, or at least he claimed so, because he then turned up and said, this is mine. It was left by a friend of mine. He left it in the underground car park and said he'd leave it in a bin there for me to collect. Unfortunately, when I got there, the cleaner seemed to have taken it away. And underground car parks at night, immediately, I think, just like old times, Deep Throat, Hal Holbrook, here we go again. But anyway, it may be a complete red herring, but it's wonderfully evocative, the idea of a bag in a bin in an underground car park late at night, which has in it a laptop, a mobile phone, and lots of papers belonging to Rebecca Brooks. Mm. What could be more agreeable than that?
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a very agreeable conversation, and I've enjoyed it. And I thank you for joining us, Francis Wheen.
Not at all. It's a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Francis Wheen, who's a journalist, broadcaster, and writer. He's the deputy editor of the British satirical magazine Private Eye. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment.
Asylum seekers, yeah. Immigrants, people who are unlike themselves, and the scapegoating and the demonising of different people. It's part of a process that's been contributed by particularly our tabloid media and its coverage of such issues on a daily basis.
Listen up now with what I'm saying is, listen up now what Rupert Murdoch, he thinks his country's his. He thinks he can say lies every day, but the fact of the matter is, it ain't none of them their business, no it ain't none of them their biz. See, it